The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and now and then we dip into our Book Nook archive and pull out a goodie from the past. And today we're going back 20 years for an interview I recorded in studio with Kathleen Norris. Back in 1999, she had a book out called Amazing Grace, A Vocabulary of Faith. My guest is Kathleen Norris. Kathleen, this grandmother that you mentioned who was affiliated with this church for 60 years, was your reference to have the opportunity to preach in the church. She used to write you letters when you were at Bennington, and you'd read them, and they'd be very, this is what's going on at home sort of letters. And then she would shift into a page where she would be talking about religion and about Jesus. And you never really understood what she was saying until years later.
You know, actually, that's the other grandmother.
Okay.
In all my books, I really write about both grandmothers, because the grandmother whose house I live in now was what I call the sane Presbyterian. Her language was always pretty down to earth, but her faith was obviously really deep. To everyone who ever knew her, she was a Christian lady, you know, born in 1881. Still wore white gloves to go downtown in the 1950s. That's how you did things. But her language and her mercy and her grace and all those things were really on the surface there on earth. The other grandmother was who I call my wild Methodist. I mean, she really had that kind of fire-breathing, hellfire and damnation approach to religion. And it really was her, and I really loved her, but that language used to terrify me as a kid. And as I described, the letters that I would get from her, all of a sudden it would go into this incredible jargon that I knew meant something to her, but it sounded a lot like what you hear on the TV evangelists, and there were all these really loaded words. And I think in a funny way, now she's been dead for many years, but I think in a funny way this book, Amazing Grace, is my response to those letters. It's my response to that kind of jargon saying, you know, I'm going to live with these words in this religion, so I have to really have an adult grasp of them, try to understand them a little better, and never let them become jargon. And my great advantage in writing the book is that my editor's Jewish, so she wouldn't let me get away with writing Christian jargon. And that was really fun for both of us.
The book Amazing Grace, A Vocabulary of Faith, is a book of essays and meditations on words and phrases that are familiar to most of us. Some words we probably don't really think about very much. Other words are maybe a little obscure to some listeners, but the way that you talk about the words and your thoughts are so measured. What was the process? How did you decide, first of all, what words to talk about, and then how did you go about it?
The process, I'm glad it seems measured to you. I mean, really came out of anguish and chaos, because, you know, going back to church after pretty much a day was really painful, and the services were an ordinary church service would feel to me like a bombardment with these words that I just didn't. I thought, what am I doing here? I mean, that was my typical response. But for some reason, I just kept wanting to go back. I thought, this is my tradition. There must be something. There was something here for my grandparents. There must be something in my mother and father. There's something here for me. I have to find out what. And so basically, when I went to working on this book, I picked the words that had most troubled me, that had been really hard, like the word creed and the creeds themselves. That was a real stumbling block for so long and still is to some extent. It's still not my absolute favorite part of any worship service. That would be the hymn singing. I love that. But words that troubled me, other times they were words where all of a sudden I would realize that my understanding of them was so narrow and so limited, and I would be given a new understanding of the word belief, for instance, which is I believe. Well, at the Greek root, it means I give my heart to. And I think we've turned it into a head trip. I think normally if we ask somebody, what do you believe, we're really asking, what do you think? And that doesn't do the word justice at all. It really is a gut level, heart level, sort of all-encompassing, holistic thing. That's belief. It isn't just a list of things you can say yes or no to, and it's all neat and ordered. Trying to think of some other words that were real revelations to me. Righteous used to really bother me. I always heard it in terms of self-righteous. And when I began to know the prophets better, and, you know, Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel, I realized that they used the word righteous in a very specific sense. The person who is righteous in God's eyes, according to the prophets, is someone who is doing justice for the poor. And in ancient Israel, that they say the widows and orphans, but basically trying to help people who are destitute, outcasts of society, can't help themselves. And so it has nothing to do with self-righteousness. It's a wonderful word, but it's sort of, you know, for me anyway, it had really lost all meaning. And I was very happy to recover that biblical sense of the word.
Well, for a poor wretch like me to read this book,
Amen, brother.
I was so full of joy to read your take on different things. And I'm a believer that we're all here to tell our stories, and you say the same thing in your own way in the book. And you tell so many stories in the book. Some of them are very uplifting. Some of them are scary. The one where the Lutheran bishop is getting in your face, that is an incredible story.
Well, that was a pretty ugly thing. And, you know, the thing is that one of the points I want to make in the book, and I think I do, is that Christians are often, you know, stereotyped, just like Islamic people are, as they're all fundamentalists, they're all crazy, they're all right-wing wackos, and it's just not true. And if it were true, I think I'd be pretty depressed. So I wanted to make that point, but I also had to tell the stories about a couple of times where I really have run into a very narrow-minded people who just, and this Lutheran bishop was not a particularly conservative Christian, really, or not right-wing, not what we would call the Christian right or any of that. But he just didn't speak my language, and I didn't speak his, and it took a Benedictine monk to kind of come between us and save the day, because this guy was really assaulting me with all these words that I wasn't quite ready to use yet. And I thought about that. I mean, that experience happened a long time ago, over 10 years ago, and I sort of kept that story to myself for a long time until I found a way to use it and tell it in this book. Because what the monk was trying to defend me against this guy who was just really off the wall, and the monk said, well, she's a woman of faith. And I'm going, a monk is calling me a woman of faith? My God, I never thought of myself that way. It gave me a whole new identity, in a sense. So I put it in the chapter called Faith, and the wonderful thing about it was the eve of my 40th birthday. It was like, you know, the synchronicity there was just astonishing. So it is a good story. And I get bored just telling all my own stories, so I like to, and I live in a small town where there's just teeming with stories, so I like to include a lot of other people's stories they've told me or things that I've seen them do, and I think it makes the book a little more balanced than if it's just my voice.
Well, your husband, as a bartender, obviously ran into some amazing stories. The one about the fellow that thought he'd get involved in the drug trade, and he's riding down the road with another guy, supposedly his partner, and the guy sees somebody drive by the other way, and he says, oh, hey, I want to kill that guy. And you know,
and he meant it, yeah. And our friend didn't realize that this guy had a gun under the seat where he was riding. I mean, classic case of being in the wrong place at the wrong time. I mean, our friend could have gone up on some kind of murder rep for being there if this guy had done that. And it's probably a typical oil patch drug dealing kind of story, but the point was that this guy just said, you know, he realized he was getting in over his head, and he just came back home and was trying to work on the farm and just do things around. His dreams of making a lot of money in the Montana, Wyoming oil patch had sort of evaporated. And I use that's the chapter on salvation, because his decision there, his turning away from what he was headed toward is basically a kind of salvation. It gets you on taking the right road instead of one that is probably going to end in your destruction. I wanted to try to take words like salvation, which can seem so abstract and strange, and try to give them a body, incarnate them a little bit, like in this fellow's story. And I'll never forget it. I mean, he spent the night on our couch because he was too drunk to drive home, so my husband, the bartender, brings him home, and I made him breakfast. And that conversation happened long before I was even going to church. I remember sort of watching people walk up to the church up my sidewalk. And, you know, at that point, I still had no intention of joining them. But it all came together in the book, I guess.
In the world of radio, we have a lot of folks out there who listen very closely, and they react to things. And hosting this program over the years, I've had people react. I've had a gentleman call me once and complain that the song I was playing was atheistic. I had a woman who wrote me a month later and said that a guest that I had on who claimed that she'd seen the Virgin Mary, you know, we were turning into evangelicals here and that we should be a Christian radio station. These are meant to be critiques, friendly critiques. Even recently, someone complained that we were, you know, turning into a Jesus station just because I played some gospel music. People are very quick to react to anything that seems to have a religious connotation. We have a culture right now where there are people that are searching for meaning in their lives, they're searching for spirituality, but we have so many people who say, I'm not in an organized religion, I don't believe in God.
That's why I have in my book many chapters about religious inheritance, and one of them is called Blessing and Curse, because I think for most people, myself included, your religious inheritance is both a blessing and a curse, and a lot of us get more comfortable, really, with that curse side. We know that somebody scared us with a boogeyman God in Sunday school, or we had relatives who just drove us crazy, and you know, you get the people who, they're so afraid of the human imagination, they say things like, The Wizard of Oz is satanic literature, you know, and so there's all kinds of crazy things that people do in the name of religion. But I think the good news about religion, and I think it really applies to all the world's religions, is that there are so many ordinary people going about their lives practicing their faith. And that, to me, is they've been able to take whatever curses and blessings they've been handled and make it a blessing for themselves and the people around them. And I think that's really, for me, the goal of being a Christian. It's not myself. It's not necessarily saving myself. It's a very communal religion, just like Judaism, based in a community. And you're really there with and for others. And that's, I think, one of the points that seems to get missed when we over-intellectualize Christianity or any religion, that somehow I can't believe this, I'm this other person. Well, that's fine, but where is your community then? And some people have other communities. And I think, in a sense, for years I did what my husband is still doing, I think poetry. And the community of poets, in a sense, substituted for religion in my life. And it worked really well, and I think it does work well for some people. I got to the point where it no longer worked for me. I needed to seek, you know, something else. And I get letters, I get responses somewhat similar to you. You know, here I've written a book that really is a pretty Christian in orientation, and I got a letter from, I think, a Southern Baptist in Tennessee who thought my faith in Jesus Christ was wishy-washy. You know, and so, well, okay, she may be right for all I know, or, you know, or one of my friends who's a writer just calls me Sister Strange. He doesn't know what to make of my going back to religion. And some of my friends, it was the last thing they ever expected me to do. It was probably the last thing I expected to do. But I reserved the right to speak about it and say, this is what's been happening. And I wrote a book that I hope, this was the hope also of my editor, my Jewish editor, to write a book that talks about ordinary garden variety Christianity. I mean, no visions, no special stuff, just my experience and my experience in this small town church of perfectly ordinary people who have this inexplicable faith in God, in Jesus Christ, in the Holy Spirit. And there you have it. And people can take it or leave it. But that's what I was trying to do. So someone who's a Hindu or a Muslim or an atheist or whatever can read the book and say, oh, that's what those crazy people mean by this, by incarnation or whatever, you know. It was a fun book to write in that sense because I tried to write it with the broadest possible audience in mind. And sometimes I feel like when I get real bitter complaints from both sort of the conservative and the liberal side, then I'm doing something right. You know, if both sides are complaining, then I think I've done what I want to do.
Well, Kathleen, reading the book, I really felt like you were a kindred spirit. I love to read books. Books are really a refuge for me. There is so much in books, and there are so many books. There's just not enough time to read all the great books that are out there. And you are constantly quoting from authors going back to the 4th century, the 3rd century. You obviously love to read books. And someone who you mention frequently in the book, and I'm assuming that she must be a kindred spirit to you, is Emily Dickinson.
Oh, yes. From high school on, both her poems and her letters. And I always return to her. I mean, she's somebody I'll never stop reading because she does seem, in a funny sense, a kindred spirit. You find in her letter she was a great critiquer of sermons. And, of course, she went to church until she was 33, which a lot of people don't realize that. And her family had these daily, very typical 19th century Christians, had daily Bible reading. I think the Bible, she refers to the Bible in everything she wrote, letters and poems. She was very steeped in the Bible. And that, she inspires me. I feel like maybe I should take 10 years off and learn the Bible as well as she knew it. She's, I think, my base starting, because I came to her very young. I loved her when I was in high school, and she's sort of the basis of a lot of my inspiration. And she's so free with the Bible. I mean, my favorite comment of hers, and I think of this as a good piece of biblical commentary, she said, "Consider the lilies as the only commandment I ever obeyed."
That's wonderful.
She's full of things like that. She takes the Bible and plays with it in a way that only the way someone who really took the Bible seriously and really knew it and loved it could do. I mean, that's the kind of play it is. It's very serious play. And her poems about the crucifixion, I mean, are just so, and there's so many of them throughout her life. They're just astonishing. I mean, she was a wonderful Christian, but after the age of 33, when she stopped really socializing with people, church was one of the things that went too. She just stopped going.
Kathleen, you illustrate your words and phrases in so many different ways, and often you'll give an anecdote, a primary anecdote, and then you'll fill in with more anecdotes. And one that really comes to mind is the burglar in the monastery. And then you talk about how people out in the desert in the 4th century were frequently robbed. And this is just wonderful history.
Well, books were extremely valuable then. So, like, they might steal their Gospels. And one monk just shrugged and said, "Well, they stole the book that told me to give all I have to the poor." You know, I was like, and one of the reasons that I wanted to use so many of those wonderful stories from the 4th and 6th century monastic writers is that they're so little known, and they really constitute a wonderful form of literature. I found them through Thomas Merton. The Wisdom of the Desert is New Directions paperback. That is his personal collection of his favorites and a wonderful introduction to the whole history of monasticism. It's a marvelous little book, and I think Shambhala now has it out in a little pocket-sized book that I carry with me, because those stories are just so – they're very much like Zen stories. There's even some evidence that some of the monks and some of the early Christian theologians were aware of the Buddha. That's an interesting area that's getting explored now by the scholars. But they're very much like Zen stories. They're very practical, but also very, very deeply wise in terms of human psychology and how we fool ourselves, how self-delusions are really this thing we're up against all the time. And these monks, with literally nothing to do all day except to pray and make their little baskets and whatever subsistence living that they were trying to make, they were subject to boredom. They were subject to all sorts of anger, lust, everything would sort of come up within, and they had to deal with it, and they dealt with it in very creative ways and often very funny ways. You know, they're just great stories, and so every book I write, I try to share as many of those as I can. And, the stories of being robbed are that's really, monks live very openly in the world, and they take a risk. And even now, down at Gethsemane Abbey, Thomas Merton's Abbey at Kentucky, a few years ago, there was one of their former abbots. This elderly man was in a hermitage, and some young punks came and beat him up. I mean, he survived, and they went to jail. But, you know, these things happen even now. But monks have a way of sort of coping with these crazy things that happen and taking it in stride. And that's what those stories reveal. That one wonderful story was this guy was getting robbed, and he realizes that the burglars have left something behind that he had hidden, so he runs out afterwards and gives it to him. Say, "You forgot this, you know." And these guys are so overwhelmed with this crazy man doing this. Immediately they convert, and they all become Christians, and they all become monks or something. I mean, who knows how much exaggeration is going on there. But the basic point was that the thieves were converted, that they were changed their way of life. And some of the early monks, Abba Moses, who was known to be an African, black African man. He was a former highwayman, robber, murderer, and ended up as this renowned wise father, you know, that monks would come from miles around just to see him and hear his wisdom. That the point is that people, no matter what they're doing with their life, they can change. And religious conversion traditionally has been a big part of that, and it was certainly in the 4th century desert. So it is a great history, and I feel really privileged that I've been able to explore it as much as I have, and I like to share it with readers.
And in your section on heretics and heresy, you have another fellow from the same period. I can't think of his name, but he was a renowned scholar, and he wrote some pieces that are still used, but he thought that the Christian religion had gotten too normal and too stable, and he ended up creating his own religion.
Yeah, Tertullianism, yes, yes, a kind of fierce brand of, the church got too easy on people, and he was one of those real hard-headed fanatics who wanted things to be hard, you know. Should have moved to Vermont. I mean, come on, you know, you find these really interesting characters, and I like to try to bring some of these guys to life because if you read their writings, I mean, they're pretty interesting characters. Their individuality shines forth. So that's another reason I like to include a lot of those stories in the book.
The book is Amazing Grace, A Vocabulary of Faith by Kathleen Norris. One of the words that really blazes off the page, and there's smoke and there's ashes, is the word Inquisition. And it's going on right now in Kosovo.
Oh, sure. Well, yeah, maybe not exactly the sense that I mean, but I think there are inquisitorial ways in our brains. I mean, there's an inquisitorial way to have a normal conversation. If someone is trying to trap you, to catch you in something, to pin you down, ordinary conversation between two friends can be turned into an inquisition. It's a state of mind that people get themselves into. And it's probably, and it can happen under any circumstance. Unfortunately, religions, including Buddhism and other, religions and in Islam, they have tended to lend themselves to be used in an inquisitorial way. It's like, sometimes those methods make sense in law, but they don't make necessarily sense when you're talking about the love that I think is at the heart of human religion. And so there's always that tension between the law and love, and I'm going to look for it. Yeah, find the chapter, because I had a lot of fun writing that. I mean, I think I start out talking about some of the worst examples of the Christian religion. But what people don't understand is like Buddhists, medieval Buddhist inquisitions that had to do a lot with politics, nationalist politics, and things. But the Buddhist inquisitions of Christians and all of the same sort of torture methods, all those things, came up. But I think we sort of stereotype inquisition means a Christian inquisition against another religion, and which it certainly has meant that, but that's not all it means. And I really think of it as a mentality that we, every one of us, has to avoid. I mean, the Inquisition in El Salvador, Kosovo, those kinds of things. I quote Carolyn Forché's wonderful poem. She said that the atrocities in El Salvador convinced her that there is nothing one man will not do to another. And I think that's just human history. I don't think religion necessarily causes that sort of thinking. I don't think it certainly wasn't the heart of what was, power was what was at the heart of what was going on in El Salvador. And I'm going to read a little bit. The best response to the spirit of Inquisition I know of comes from the 14th century Flemish mystic John van Ruysbeck. Near the end of his life, he was confronted with a theologian who condemned him for being soft, arguing that it was far better to fear a vengeful God than to live with the false understanding that God loves you. Now, this rings some bells with me in contemporary American Christianity. It's far better to fear a vengeful God than to live with the false understanding that God loves you. This came at a time in the church history when a condemnation could have easily led to the inquisitor's rack. Von Rosbuch's response was to say that he had not the slightest fear of accepting whatever God had in mind for him. In fact, he could think of nothing better or more joyful. In essence, he had lived too long in love with God to change. And that is a class act from the 14th century. I mean, I think that's really... better represents the heart of the Christianity I know than these offshoots where there have been these periods, like the Spanish Inquisition is the most famous, but there was a horrendous Inquisition in India that came out of Spain and Portugal.
The one in Goa.
Goa. Mm-hmm. Just horrendous, and it didn't end until the 19th century. I mean, that was one of the things researching this book. I found out some pretty grim things. But I think that whole thing of trusting God and trusting God's love, that's what I have to do as a Christian. And I mean, I'm siding with von Ruysbeck here that the so-called all angry, all vengeful God you know, the people claim to find in the Bible. Well, there's a lot of other things going on there, too. That's not the full picture, and it's not the one that I live with, I guess, on a daily basis.
You just used a word that you defend in the book that is used as somewhat of an aspersion in our modern day, and that is medieval.
Oh, yes.
But, you know, the thing about this book, Kathleen, that really amazed me, as I read the book, I kept thinking, I want to ask her about this, and I want to mention this, and I want to talk about this. And then I realized that it would be an 18-hour interview.
Well, we could do it, you know, marathon week, you know.
I wish I could. I'm looking at the clock, and I feel like I've been speaking to you for just a minute, so I guess I haven't been conducting an inquisition. This has been more
not
of
at all. It's been a conversation. Mostly I've been rambling on. But, you know, the word medieval, and this, again, came from because Benedictines, men and women, tend to be very close to the Middle Ages because that's really so much a part of their fairly recent history. They can go back to 1,500 years ago, or St. Benedict, who was the 6th century. But just hanging around them, I learned so much more about the medieval era and medieval writers and medieval mystics and poets. Mechthild of Magdeburg was a wonderful discovery. She's really a great poet. She was a nun, kind of a fierce nun, but she wasn't a cloistered nun until the end of her life. She was living out in the streets. I mean, she was like maybe the Mother Jones of nundom or something in the Middle Ages, this wild woman, wonderful poet. And I discovered her, and discovering more about the Middle Ages, I really became to resent the fact that people use medieval as a put-down. Oh, that's so medieval. And I know the part of the Middle Ages they're referring to, but actually I think the mentality of the Middle Ages was much more open-minded than we realize, and in some ways much more elastic than our own. I mean, able to live in what Keats called negative capability. We're always looking to sort things out and to pare down and to do things faster and categorize and all that stuff. And the medieval mind was much more happy to sort of say, well, you know, seeing connections between science and religion, not contradictions. We tend to see contradictions. The medieval mind tended to be more free to explore in many ways, areas that I think modern people are afraid to explore. So I try to resurrect that word. It's not always a negative word.
The book is Amazing Grace, A Vocabulary of Faith. And my guest has been Kathleen Norris. And Kathleen, I hope we can continue this conversation another time.
Yeah, be great. I'd love to come back to Ohio.
You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. Since 1958, you've been listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. And going back to 1999, an interview I did with Kathleen Norris for a book that she had put out that year called Amazing Grace, A Vocabulary of Faith. I looked her up on Wikipedia to see what she's been up to. She spent summers on her grandparents' farm outside of Lemon, South Dakota. She went to Bennington College in 1969. And when her grandparents died, she inherited their farm and moved there with her husband, David Dwyer. They became members of the Spencer Memorial Presbyterian Church. Her husband died back in 2003. And since then, she's been living in Hawaii. A very interesting conversation with Kathleen Norris. And maybe someday we'll have her back on the program again. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks, as always, for tuning in.